I hear that song and I'm moved to want to do interpretive dance. So, but I've probably been watching Dance Moms too much on Lifetime, so that's my problem. But it's a perfect theme for Pirates of Barbary, Corsairs, Conquests, and Captivity in the 17th Century Mediterranean. Adrian Tiniswood is a super great historian and author and lecturer. He does a little broadcasting on his own, and he tells a great story in Pirates of Barbary. Honestly, this is a wonderful read from beginning to end. I'm about three quarters of the way through it. I always seem to get three quarters of the way through a book by the time I get to Saturday. I got to go back and finish it on Monday and Tuesday of the following week. This is no different, but it's a page turner. And it's really interesting to keep making the comparisons between both our current piracy problem around the world, but also, and I'll start off with Adrian Tiniswood in just a second, it also the problem we have with terrorism. And there is a comparison there too to get to, but we learn a lot by looking back, and we'll do that coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Pirates of Barbary is a story that gets started as Adrian Tiniswood was following his curiosity about a particular family. We'll get back to that coming up on Coast to Coast and how it can inform us about our pirate situation today. Let me just first start by saying thank you and good evening, or is it good morning for you?
It's good morning for me. Good morning for me, Ian, but good evening to you. It's great to be on the show.
Well, it's just a terrific book. It's just so engaging.
Oh, you're
And
so kind. You're so kind.
but it's really true. And even in the preface, you start to make the point that there are lessons of history to be learned about how we can deal with our current piracy problem, which we see, no near future of ending.
No, it's I think if anything, it's getting worse rather than better. I mean, at the moment, we're in the middle of the biggest anti-piracy operation that the world has ever seen. I think there's something, I've lost count, there's something like 29 nations have got a military presence in the Horn of Africa. The Japan has relaxed its pacifist constitution so it can send warships to protect its merchant shipping. The EU has got its first, the European Union has got its very first combined naval operation. The Fifth Fleet's been out there for a while with its combined Task Force 151, and they're no closer. They're no
Yeah.
closer. Again, the last time I looked, I'm probably a little bit out of date. Your listeners can correct me, but the last time I looked, Somali pirates were holding 19 vessels and something like 690 crew, and
And
that's
it pays
enormous.
off. And it pays off. I mean, they get 3 million for this ship or 3.4 million for that ship.
Absolutely
And
right. Yeah, I mean, vast amounts. The last story I heard, which was in the spring, was that property prices in downtown Nairobi were spiraling as Somali pirates pour the insurance money they're getting into legitimate property enterprises.
amazing. And for the same reason that it's still winning, it's winning for the same reason that we saw piracy win back in the 17th century as well. And that's because bigger isn't necessarily better. And just because you have a bigger ship, it doesn't mean that you're more able to fight off a pirate. In fact, sometimes smaller is absolutely the way to go. And we're not sending smaller. We've got bigger out there.
Yeah, I think small and fast, but also, Ian, if I mean, I'm not sure that history we have. Well, history may teach us stuff. I'm not sure we ever learn from it. That's slightly different, isn't it?
Yeah,
But I mean,
fair enough.
if we learn anything, it's that you don't solve piracy, the problem of piracy on the high seas. You actually solve it on land. At the moment, I'm sure we can talk more about this later on, but a lot of it has got to do with Somalia being a failed state, and the
Right.
solutions lie in Somalia, not in the Indian Ocean or the Horn of Africa.
All right, so and we will get to that because I do think that I hold out hope that we will learn the lessons of
Yeah.
history. But it's a fascinating history, so if we don't learn anything, it's okay too because it's still a good read. So the I mean let and I want to make a claim from the beginning, and I didn't see you make this claim yet, but I haven't quite finished the book. So here's how I'm also reminded of terrorism. and about Al Qaeda. So we're not just talking about, you know, Somalia, as you point out so accurately, has the longest coast of any African country or something like that. So they've got a lot of areas to go, grab ships, grab people, hide. I mean, they can go back and forth pretty easily. But there is a component to piracy, both today and in the 17th century, that was focused on terrorism, and it scared the legitimate ship operators, and it was an economic kind of terrorism, and it's not terribly different, I think, in a lot of ways, maybe than 9/11. If we look at, you know, you have a small band of you know, sort of loosely confederated people, some multinationals, just like you would have had in any pirate group, and they saw as their goal to bring down the World Trade Center, to create economic havoc and to create terror, which got them money on the back end from other people that wanted to invest in them. Not to mention, just as the head of the 17th century, state-sponsored piracy, you've got state-sponsored terrorism for the same reason today. Am I wrong in making that kind of comparison?
No, I mean, I terrorism is such a value-loaded word. I mean, I think you're absolutely right in so many ways. I mean, let me tell you, my guys in the 16th century, my guys, I feel like I own them, you know, the pirates of Barbary, my pirates, they didn't call themselves pirates. They called themselves mujahideen. They didn't talk about robbing. They talked about being on jihad against the West. That's in the 16th century. That's 500 years ago, 600 years ago. The thing is that they were doing it in many ways for the same reasons that they saw. We ought to maybe, I'm sure all of your listeners will be absolutely clear about where Barbary is, but just in case there are one or two that aren't, I maybe just ought to sort of locate us geographically. Would that be okay?
Oh, yeah, by all means.
In that the Barbary coast starts, if you can picture Africa, it starts on the top left of Africa, the Atlantic coast of Morocco, and the Barbary coast moves round into the Mediterranean. So the top of Africa, basically. And Barbary is Morocco, it's Algiers, it's Tunis, and it's Libya. That 2,000-mile stretch is the Barbary coast, and that's where my guys came from. And one of the reasons that they were so powerful was that this was the sort of major shipping lane. I mean, you know, this was where all the sort of trade went on in the Mediterranean. So they could take a pop at Christian merchant shipping. There's plenty of it. But it was a front line in a battle between Christendom and Islam. Because to the east, you've got the Ottoman Empire, you've got Turkey, you've got this huge Islamic empire. To the west, you've got the Christian states, Spain, France, Holland, Italy, and of course Great Britain, and it's a battleground. So that's where your parallels really are. I think it's a battleground between Christendom and Islam in the 16th and 17th century.
Yeah, and but I also see that the same type of terrorism. And I understand when you say it's a loaded word, but I'm going to go with it in the sense that there was, I mean, as you point out so appropriately in the book, there were songs, plays. A lot of British popular culture was being formed by fear of these pirates and what they were doing to shipping and what they were doing to families. And it created a very tense situation, not just between Christendom and Islam, but also in that the country felt under attack. And that's just what these pirates were hoping for, because that makes their job easier.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. I mean, these guys in the 17th century, in the 1600s, these guys had a strength. They had the economies of the West by the throat. They just controlled them. There is a theory that the Venetian Republic, which was enormously powerful in the Middle Ages, that it came to an end because of the pirates. You know, because it just could not cope. If you think that, you know, all of your trade is carried on, almost all of it is carried on by sea. You know, and I'd say the major trade routes through the Mediterranean, that's where you're getting rid of your goods, that's where you're buying in luxury goods. And that means that you're prey, you know, you can so easily fall prey to these guys operating out of North Africa.
Right. And just like, to explore that subject just a titch further, is that – just like terrorists today wouldn't consider themselves to be terrorists, they might also call themselves Mujahideen. They might also consider themselves to have a higher cause. Like many of the Somali pirates might think of what they're doing as having some sort of higher cause. It still comes down to they knew they were committing crimes. They knew that there were things that were taking place, but they just had a way of framing it so that they weren't guilty. I mean, it was some of that had to do with a clever justification that allowed them to do what they were doing, even though they were being internationally hunted.
Sure. I mean, they were. I think the thing is that people's motives, you know, that they're seldom pure and never simple. That,
right.
That, you know, you've got some of these guys were robbers, just as with a lot of the Somali pirates. They were robbers. They were thieves. They were, you know, they were out to steal. Some of them were ideologues. They were warriors for God. They were, you know, they were Islamic, the Mujahideen. And right. Some of them were a bit of both. And some of them would use religion to justify what they did. Some of them didn't care. Some of them weren't religious at all. You know, you've got this whole range of motives that pirates were using and which were being, you know, moved by pirates in the 17th century. But certainly that battle between Christendom and Islam is central to it.
Right. And Christendom, of course, you know, I'll be the first to accuse Christendom of also corrupting its own values for various purposes, political or otherwise, nationalistic. But oddly enough, there's another echo in that. I think it was like the third or fourth chapter, you talk about the pirate, was it John Ward? What was the name of the? Okay. Who started off as at least, you know, titularly Christian captain of one of these ships, a hired captain for one of these pirate ships, who ends up converting to Islam. Yeah. And his conversion to Islam was more offensive to Great Britain than the fact that he was a pirate.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, I think there's two things there. I mean, the reason I got into this book is I was studying a noble English family called the Verneys, who were
you wrote another book on them, right? Wasn't that one of your other books?
They're a fantastic family. They really are. But one of them came over to Virginia in the 1620s, 1630s, one of the early colonists. But I mean, but one of these Verneys, 1608, Francis Verney, head of a family, landed gentry, he falls out with his mother-in-law, and well, you know, that happened even in 17th century England.
Right.
He walks out on his wife, and that happens sometimes. But Francis Verney carried on walking till he got to Morocco, where he converted to Islam and became a Barbary Coast pirate. And I thought, what? How did that happen? How does an English gentleman turn Turk, is the phrase that was used in the 17th century.
Right.
Turn Turk. How does he convert? And I thought, you know, that's got to have been really rare. And as I studied it, I found that it wasn't, that thousands of English sailors and English gentlemen converted to Islam in the 17th century. And, you know, some of them became pirates and Barbary and didn't convert. Some of them converted and converted back. But some of the big guys, yeah, I mean, John Ward, the fellow you mentioned, he was known in the 17th century as the arch pirate of all the world. He was the most feared pirate in the world. And he lived happily. His name was Yusuf, Captain Yusuf Rais. He converted, took an Islamic name, and lived in a palace of alabaster and gold in Tunis with a Muslim wife called Jessamine. And he lived happily ever after. You know, he made that. It's an amazing culture change.
Right.
And, you know, he made that change. Now, just one quick point before we move on is that you talk about it being a two-way street, you know, that Christendom was not entirely blameless in this.
Yeah.
And we've got to say, yeah, you're right. I mean, one of the reasons for the rise of Barbary piracy was that a couple of Turkish brothers, who we call the Barbarossa brothers in the West, Oruk and Hizir, Oruk was going about his business one day, taking pottery around the Eastern Mediterranean, when he was captured by the Christian Knights of St. John, who were operating out of Rhodes. And their job, they thought, going back to the Crusades, their job was to attack Muslim shipping. They were pirates as well. They robbed Islamic shipping. They enslaved Muslim sailors. So it was very much a two-way street. I mean, it was when Oruk was finally released from captivity by the Knights of St. John, that he said, well, I'm going to try some of this too.
Right. You know,
so no one's blameless.
Sure.
That's one thing history does teach you, I think.
And I think what it also shows is that so often things aren't about, to use a phrase, they're not about a demographic, they're about a psychographic.
Oh, that's so true.
Right? And so it's just like we have today people who are raised middle class, very successful, college educated, and something inside of them is drawn toward the terrorist life. And suddenly they give up everything they have and they go out to the desert and they start training as a terrorist and start making videotapes.
Yeah.
And the families are confused. The school is confused. The girlfriend that they left at the altar is confused.
Yeah.
I mean, it appeals to some. It's maybe just the slightly more powerful, elusive, mysterious version of running off to join the circus.
It's a power twist. It's something that historians don't make enough of these days, I think, that war and conflict is exciting.
Yep.
It's a kick. It's a thrill. You know, I mean, we hear, Lord knows, we hear so much about the horrors of war, which are absolutely real. I wouldn't want to downplay that for a second. But the fact is, when you're in it, it can be a kick. And there's that sort of, you know, piracy, as you say. I mean, I think that's a brilliant metaphor, running away to join the circus. You know, there was a glamour. There was a romance to it. I mean, the guy I was telling you about, Francis Verney, when his family, in the 19th century, they kind of discovered they had a pirate in their pedigree. And they thought it was great. It was wonderful that back in the day, one of their ancestors had been a pirate. And it was, you know, it was romantic. When they found out he'd converted to Islam, they just said, no, he didn't. I mean, total denial. It's all very well. If you're an English gentleman, you can have a pirate in the family, and that's cool. To have a Muslim in the family is not.
But it's so interesting. Because again, we're talking about the Pirates of Barbary, and we'll get more into the story here of these of this 17th century battle and what it can teach us today. Adrian Tinniswood is our guest. I would say that then, just to take this to the bottom of the hour, that there's also the, as you mentioned appropriately, that, you know, war can be exciting and alluring, and that's always been true, and it's true for every society who thinks that this has become some sort of test of manhood. But I think when your story of Francis Verney also speaks to a particular type of person who looked ahead down the road of his life and saw sameness, saw everything plotted out. He was going to be doing everything. He was going to be connecting the dots for the rest of his life. And he was going to have a mother-in-law that was going to be carping on him. And he was going to, and he looked at that and he just went a little mad and just said, I need some excitement. And that thing that people do where they try to bring meaning to their life by attaching themselves to something bigger than them.
That's very perceptive, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's what happened. He just kept on walking until he came to something that was bigger than him, that he could say, look, this will define my life. This is how I will say I existed.
Yes, as you say, when it's a choice between a mother-in-law and a life of piracy, I'm not sure the right road, but he took.
Yeah, we'll just say it's different road. We don't have to say right or wrong. He took a different path. Well, and this is a great way to really get into more of the discussions. I want you to talk about, you brought up the Venetians. And I think that will inevitably lead us to back to a conversation about ships and about the size of these ships.
Yeah.
And the ones, both the size of the ships that were legitimately transporting goods and services and the ones that were doing the raiding. Let's get into some of the numbers of this conflict between the haves and the want-to-haves.
The want-to-haves, yeah.
In the Pirates of Barbary. Can't say have-nots because they were doing quite well for themselves, and we'll get to that coming up next. Adrian Tinniswood is a lecturer and an author and a great storyteller in Pirates of Barbary. Missed that first hour, make sure you get Coast Insider. And next time I bump into you, like when I'm doing a book signing on this coming Saturday, right? And I walk up and just say, I'm an insider. I'm loving that. It means you can go back and you can listen to any Coast to Coast show anytime you want. Podcast and all sorts of other features for just pennies a day. Find out more at coasttocoastam.com. At some point, the story of the Pirates of Barbary is a story of heroes and villains. But understand that culturally that may shift depending on one's perspective. But there are black hats and white hats a little bit in this story, mostly because of who was doing the killing, who was doing the robbing, and why. And we'll get back to that. The Pirates of Barbary, the true story of what happened to the 17th century Mediterranean on the African coast, and what we can learn from it today. And one of those things is about shipping in general, and how close are our current ship dynamics to the ship dynamics of that era. And why it is that we need to perhaps rethink things now, if we're going to learn a lesson from history. Next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. So we're talking about the Pirates of the of Barbary, or the Barbary Coast, as most people think of it. And this particular area of the Mediterranean, is, as you said, Adrian, This was the hotbed of commerce, and that a lot of money floating on these boats. So they had to accommodate that by making these giant, what were the equivalent then in the 17th century of a supertanker today. How big were these ships? I'm not hearing Adrian. Did we lose him? Can we check? We're getting a little slap back there on the phone, and I couldn't tell. Hey, by the way, while we're lining them back up again, and that'll take but a second, let me give a shout out to, P-Way Cowboy. No, P-Way Boy, June Cardinal, Vince, Vegas Cowboy, Linda, Rochelle, Apex, Jed, Chris, Tony, Marsha, and the PC Network in Minneapolis. Thank you all for following me now on Twitter. Deacon Punnett is my Twitter account, and I'm really enjoying sending out photos and other fun stuff during the week. So if you'd like to, please do. And it's a great way to keep in touch in between shows. And this is a show we started working on a long time ago, the Pirates of Barbary. I got this book. I don't know. It's out in softcover now. You can link up to this book easily by going to coasttocoastam.com. And I started reading it a couple of weeks ago, and it's just great. So I had asked before we got disconnected, Adrian, about the ships of the 17th century. They were like the super tankers of today.
Yeah, I mean, they were by today's standards, when we sort of think, you know, we're talking millions of tons, they're pretty puny. But the big sort of, you know, some of these big Venetian argosies, these great treasure ships, were like 1,500 tons. They were enormous by their standards, absolutely enormous. And that, of course, meant that they were quite slow in the water, rather like our VLCCs, you know, our very large crude carriers.
Right.
Big things.
And that worked to the pirates' advantage to a degree, and we'll talk about that. But I also like how, I mean, when we talk about big, I mean, there was a lot of timber to make ships that big. And then they had to get into a design of, what were you going to focus on safety, which again comes to our comparison today. Were you going to focus on putting guns on these ships, or were you going to focus on cargo on these ships and how much you could fit of, say, even like cotton bales? And then you get, like, if you had a ship full of cotton bales, that's a total fire hazard right there. All sorts of trade-offs you're making.
And in fact, I mean, one of the standard things, if you were attacked by pirates, you hauled those bales of cotton out onto the deck, because one of the most dangerous things in a sea battle wasn't actually the shot itself. It was the fact that it hit the timbers and you got splinters flying around the deck. So those bales would actually absorb the impact of shot. Of course, what you've got to remember, Ian, then as now, is that the pirates didn't want to sink you. They didn't want to destroy your cargo, because your ship was worth something to them. Your cargo was worth something to them. So they didn't want to wreck it. But at the same time, they relied on shock and awe. You know, they relied on intimidation. They wanted you to give up. They didn't want to fight. They wanted you just to give in.
But those big ships, especially these Venetian ships of the 17th century, they were like, I mean, I use the comparison to the supertanker because when people saw them, they just never, other than a house, other than a five-story house, a mansion, they'd never seen anything this big.
I know. They were absolutely vast. Of course, what that meant, as far as defending them goes, what that meant was that you could carry a fair few. Most of these merchant ships were armed, not heavily armed, but they would have, you know, maybe 12 or 20 cannon on board, which, I mean, to me sounds like heavily armed, but, you know.
Right.
And they would carry, you know, the crew would be fighting crew as well. So they were ready for pirate attacks. But the fact is that pirates, by and large, a huge, stupid generalization, but by and large, pirates were better sailors. They were fast. They were very effective. Go ahead.
No. I just was going to interject here just about, because you mentioned the crew. There were a lot more people on these big ships. How many more? There's like hundreds of people would be on these boats. So a lot of them would probably come never near to a tiller or to a sexton
We need to distinguish between. I mean, merchant ships would, and it's a very hard call. But merchant ships might have 50 or 60 or 70 crew on board. A pirate war galley, a heavily armed pirate galley, might have 400 people on board.
400 people?
Yep. In the 16th century, most of the robbing was done on galleys, big rowboats, just huge rowboats. So you'd have a rowing crew on a big pirate galley. You'd have a rowing crew of maybe 144 people, 72 per side.
Mm.
Then you'd have a kind of maintenance crew of about sort of 20. Then you would carry, like the Marines, you would carry a complement of soldiers, of janissaries, of fighters, and you might have 200 of those on board.
So that's phenomenal.
They were just kind of floating fighting platforms.
Yeah, and that does speak to what we have today. No, but these rowing crew, you know, the movie cliche is always that they were in chains, they were shackled, and they were the captured sailors from the previous, you know, from the previous day's catch.
That sometimes was the case. Sometimes you had galley slaves. I mean, the whole notion of slavery is a very big one. It's one perhaps we can get onto in a few moments. But some of them were volunteers. But, you know, some of them were captured Christians, sure. It was a real mix. I think the interesting thing about these ships, though, Ian, is that they were very good. They were very, a galley was very effective. You could go very fast. You could go like maybe 8 to 10 knots at a burst, you know, so you could scoot along. And you didn't have to depend on the wind. I mean, I've seen accounts of pirate galleys getting into a scrap with a big European sailing ship, and you could just row backwards. And as I say, I've seen stories about them rowing backwards till they just rowed right up on the beach, and then you could just all jump out and run away.
Right.
And a big English sailing ship couldn't get anywhere close, you know, because
no.
These things got a very shallow draft, these galleys. But their range was really restricted, because if you imagine, if you've got 400 guys on board, you can't actually take that much fresh water or supplies or food. Every 8 to 10 days, you have to put in somewhere to resupply. And it's only with the renegades that we were talking about before the bottom of the hour, renegade Englishmen and Dutchmen, what they did, they brought European navigational skills to Barbary. They taught the Barbary pirates how to sail big sailing ships. And within a few years, these guys had stripped out all the sort of superfluous timber. They'd turned European sailing ships into very effective fighting ships. And that meant that their range was vastly extended. They could really, as far as the West was concerned, they anywhere in the world they could get to.
Today we might think of that as a kind of treason, that you're selling your national technology to the highest international bidder.
And people said that then as well. I mean, yeah, it's not only today. People criticized these renegades hugely for I should say, for selling technology.
Yeah, for teaching the enemy. Yeah. But it didn't always work. And this goes back to something else we mentioned earlier. When they did attack some of these big ships, like some of these big Venetian ships, I love that story about how they took one of the, I can't remember which one it was, but they took one of those big giant ships, and because they had done so much damage to it in the fight to capture it, they had made it, they unwittingly rendered it unseaworthy.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's not only damage when they were, you're right, and when they were fighting, but also one of the first things they would do was do everything they could to lighten the ship, and they would add gun ports to it. So they were cutting holes out of the hull.
Right.
Now, a lot of the time, they were fine with that because they were very good at, you know, they're very good engineers, they were very good seamen. But sometimes they got it wrong. Now, if you've got a huge Venetian argosy and you start cutting holes in the hull, nine times out of ten it might be okay, but there's going to be that one time when it's not, you know.
And that one time in this case was it just came across a storm and the integrity of the hull had been destroyed by their attempts to try to add more gun ports. Yeah,
exactly, exactly. And I'm sure this happened quite a lot, in fact. But of course, the thing about piracy is as with all criminal activity, that the records we have, I mean, I was quite pleased to find what I did, but it's very patchy because, you know, criminals don't actually keep ledgers. You know, they don't keep diaries by and large, a lot of them. So I'm sure this happened a lot more than we realize, you know?
Yeah. Such is the work of Pirates of Barbary that you do, I think, is as great a job as anybody could to
really
recapture
kind of
the.
I appreciate
yeah,
that.
No, really mean it. Recapture Thanks. That era, and then also explain why it's relevant to us today to look at the lessons of history to see how we might fight piracy. And I do want to get back to that conversation about how this was brought under control back then, but really it comes down to it. Is whether it's today or the 17th century, the oceans are so vast, even something like the Mediterranean Sea, it's so huge. Who's there to really enforce any law? You could write any law you want, but I mean, it all comes down to is, in a way, might makes right when you're in the middle of the ocean.
Yeah. And, you know, you've also, all of the Western powers did try, every now and then, they would send a sort of punitive expedition down to Algiers or down to Tunis. But you have to bear in mind that then in the 17th century, getting ships that far was a real problem. And once you got them down to, you know, they would try to blockade Algiers, right? But you could only stay there for a few weeks because then you got to go and resupply. And if you weren't friendly with, say, the Spanish, if you'd come all the way down from England, you needed Spanish bases to resupply at, say, you know, on the northern Mediterranean. Well, if you happened to not be too friendly with Spain, and England wasn't too friendly with Spain every now and then those supply bases weren't available to you. And you just, you know, traveling 5,000 miles without knowing where the next supply of fresh water was coming from was not a very happy state of affairs. So it was a difficult, logistically, it was a really difficult thing to do.
The pirate we mentioned before, John Ward, was the guy who had taken this giant Venetian ship that had then sunk in the first storm. And the story was afterward that people wouldn't sail with him, right? Because he wasn't on the ship when it sank.
Yeah, that's the
right?
guy. But the story went round Europe that he'd gone, and everybody cheered.
And the story that was being written about him at the time that he was the most dreaded pirate of the Barbary Coast, his story was outselling Shakespeare.
Yeah, I mean they were writing plays, putting plays on the West End stage in London about. I mean, there's a play called A Christian Turned Turk, which is a dramatization of the life of John Ward. You know, at the same time as he's still alive, he's still pirating. He was a major celebrity, and by all accounts, quite an unprepossessing one. The only word picture we have of him, there are no portraits of John Ward at all, but the only word picture we have of him talks about him being sort of drunk all the time, swears a lot, bald with a beard. You know, he's not exactly Errol Flynn or Johnny Depp.
Right, but he would be Osama bin Laden.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
He was the Osama bin Laden of his era. The idea that nationally, you know, there was this kind of, everybody was coalescing around the idea of we got to get this guy.
Yeah, yeah, they were. There were even, you know, there were people sort of coming up to the English ambassador in Venice or saying, you know, look, we can assassinate him. We can take him out.
Right.
In fact, they couldn't. They were trying to sort of get money out of the English government, you know, for the crackpot schemes that weren't going to work. But yes, you did have that sense that, you know, this guy is wrecking the West, the economy of the West.
And what was the Shakespeare play that came out that didn't even do as well as the play that was out about
King Lear?
King Lear.
At the time. Didn't,
it's so funny.
Didn't do as well as A Christian Turned Turk.
As the play about John Ward. These are just some of the very interesting aspects of 17th century piracy. So we're talking about it in terms of what we can learn from it. What is dramatically different or dramatically the same about the pirating techniques of the 17th century to board and seize a ship that we still see going on off the coast of Somalia?
Well, I mean, these days it's mainly, as you know, it's mainly speedboats and scaling ladders, and used to be, and just rusty Kalashnikovs. I mean, that they, one of the things you can do with several million dollars is upscale your firepower. So they've got rather better weapons now. But I mean, with a typical pirate attack, right? You would involve the pirates just trying to intimidate you to begin with. They would try and scare you. And as the master of a ship, you've got some difficult choices to make because, you know, you can turn and run, but you know they're better sailors than you. You can stand and fight, but you know they're better fighters than you. And you don't want to make them mad. This is the thing. You really do not want to make them mad. Or you can just heave to, let them on board, and pray that they will just take your cargo. There are wonderful instances of pirate ships. There was one particular occasion when the pirate vessel came alongside a ship called the Charity, I think, I can't recall, and said to the master, you know, surrender. And the master said, no, never. So the pirates actually brought English captives in chains that they got already from below decks. And they stood there clanking their chains and saying, you know, if you don't surrender, we're all going to die. It's theater, but it's also, it goes back to what we were saying earlier. They didn't want to hurt you. You were worth something to them.
Right, but people still died. I mean, they were still, it wasn't, the pirates would still kill people. They may say that we didn't want to, you made us do it.
Oh, yeah.
But
they weren't
murder.
Yeah. But yeah, sure. And what they would try and do, I mean, if there was a brief skirmish, they were always trying to get hold of your ship. I mean, this is the one, and it could act in your favor, of course. You know, there was no point in them sinking you because you weren't worth anything if you were sunk. So there's that sort of trade-off that a captain of a merchant ship was always having to balance the probabilities, if you see what I mean. I mean, he knew that they didn't want to, and one of the things that we must talk about at some point, of course, is not only was your ship worth something to the pirates, not only was the cargo worth something to the pirates, but you were worth something to the pirates, because the pirate economy of Barbary depended on slavery and ransom. Something like 1 million Europeans were sold into slavery in Barbary in the 17th century.
Well, that's just what we're going to get to, because that's a big part of Pirates of Barbary. So let's talk about that. It is a little known aspect of history, the number of Europeans who were sold into slavery into Africa. This, you know, 150, 250 years before countries started to ban the sale of slaves from Africa to either European countries or to the new plantations in the Americas. We don't even think about it, but it happened. In fact, it happened at an amazing rate. And it's another reason why it was wise to keep women off of these ships. One of those movie cliches, you know, they talk about, we don't want any women, they're bad luck on a ship. What would happen if they got caught? Well, we'll get into that coming up. Pirates of Barbary, Corsairs, Conquests and Captivity in the 17th Century Mediterranean. Adrian Tinniswood is our guest, and we're talking about that, learning from that, how we can fight piracy today. And we know it's still going on. We'll get more of that on the way. Coast to Coast, this is Ian Bonnet.